Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record, program number 1061. Socialists for Trump and Hitler, part one. This is being recorded on March 12th of the year 2019. As I am recording this, a number of things are going on. Donald Trump and company are opening fire predictably on the Democrats as socialists, and they are specifically branding the Democrats as socialists because of activists within the left wing of the Democratic Party, some of which, such as Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, do in fact call themselves socialists. And they're also was a fairly well-publicized poll of young Americans, many of whom had come of age, so to speak, in the wake of the financial collapse of 2008. They were polled about, quote, socialism, unquote, and found it favorable. Paul Krugman, among others of the New York Times, has really pointed out something quite important, which is what they think of as socialism is really what the Republicans brand socialism, and as Krugman also pointed out, the contemporary Republican Party will brand anything to the left of eating poor people's babies as socialism. What they label as socialism is really social democracy, and the countries they label as socialist, such as Sweden and other Scandinavian countries, and even Germany to a certain extent, are not socialists, but they have strong social nets. However, they have been termed socialist, and the right wing dominates much of the political discourse in this country. So many young people have grown up thinking positively of socialism because of that. Socialism, I suspect, is going to turn out to be not only the focal point of open red baiting, as Donald Trump and Fox News are already doing, but I think it is going to prove to be a fatal to the Democrats propaganda ploy in the 2020 election. It remains to be seen if Donald Trump even survives or if it is Mike Pence. Before we get into the substance of what we're talking about here, and I'm going to do several shows in this series, and it is going to be quite challenging because for people, particularly for younger listeners, I don't know how many of them there are, but for them to really grasp this, an awful lot of what I have talked about in the past is really quite important. In a nutshell, the CIA and the GOP have long used, quote, leftist, unquote, Democrats to fragment the Democratic Party and to gain the electoral political landscape in the U.S., in this case using manipulated ballots instead of manipulated bullets, as they did in 1963 in Dallas, Texas, and as they did in 1968, first in Memphis in April and then in Los Angeles in June. Eugene McCarthy, the quote peace unquote candidate, was actually identified as CIA in the authoritative book, Who's Who in the CIA. It is a good book, although generated by East German intelligence or a ghost writer for it, Andreas Marbader, or perhaps Andreas Marbader. Anyway, it is authoritative. It does, however, sometimes identify people who are actually State Department or DIA as CIA. As stayed a source, as the late syndicated columnist Jack Anderson viewed that book as authoritative. And Eugene McCarthy is in there as CIA. Jim Hogan in Spooks has revealed that McCarthy's campaign was financed largely by a guy named Stuart Mott, whose family was a major holder, perhaps I think at one point the largest stockholder in General Motors, and they parlayed that enormous stock holding into a line of Apple products, applesauce, apple juice, and so forth. Again, Mott, M-O-T-T. At the same time as he was bankrolling the, quote, the peace candidate from the CIA, Eugene McCarthy, he also was bankrolling the financing of the weapons empire of Mitchell Werbel. We spoke about Mitchell Werbel in some of our interviews with Jim DiGemio about Destiny Betrayed and the JFK assassination and Jim Garrison's investigation into same. Werbel, known as the Thomas Edison of silenced weapons and the Wizard of Whispering Death, was inextricably linked with the CIA, with the militia movement, with commandos, and his Cobra training school was used by various elements inside and outside of the intelligence community. He is perhaps best known as the designer of the Ingram Mach-10 and Mach-11 silenced machine pistols, and Stuart Mott capitalized Environmental Industries Incorporated, which was the parent company of Werbel's that manufactured Werbel's Ingram Mach-10 and Mach-11 machine pistols. There was a grim green pun, if you will, the benign and progressive sounding name Environmental Industries Incorporated referred to the fact that its supporters felt they had a contribution to make in the area of population control. It made silenced machine guns. The history of using the quote left, unquote, note my terms, to fragment the Democratic Party is a long one, and I have long, well, not long, but when Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez first came on the scene, I was struck by the extent to which she was, from the standpoint of Donald Trump and his ilk, straight from the Sears mail order catalog, or perhaps from the Amazon mail order catalog. Trump has demonized Latinos in general and, quote, immigrants, unquote, in particular. Ocasio is a Latina. She calls herself a democratic socialist. And she has amassed quite a following on social media and has already made some other significant factual errors, although those have not yet quite come back to haunt her. In particular, she helped to quash Amazon's prospective deal with New York City to open one of its headquarters buildings in Long Island City in Queens. And that, I think, is something of a Janus-faced proposal. I think on the balance, it would have been positive for New York City, would have generated billions of tax revenues, but it also certainly would have brought with it many of the attendant ills of gentrification. Perhaps that could have been negotiated. I don't know. I suspect that we have nefarious elements on both sides of that. But certainly, AOC, as she is called, has already become something of the poster child on the far right for putting down the Amazon deal. I'm going to come back to GOP election and investment strategy, which are twined later on in this series. I have wondered again about AOC and how she came to being. She was largely elevated as the result of an organization called Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, Democrats, and an overlapping organization called Brand New Congress. The driving force behind Justice Democrats and also a co-founder of BNC, Brand New Congress, was an Indian American named Saikat, S-A-I-K-A-T, I may be mispronouncing, or Saikat Chakrabarty, C-H-A-K-R-A-B-A-R-T-I. When Ocasio-Cortez first broke on the scene, it was mentioned that she was elected to represent largely the Parkchester section of the Bronx. formerly a working class and lower middle class Jewish neighborhood. It is now Latino and has a very large Indian American population. I don't mean Native American, but Indian American. And Indian Americans are the second fastest growing demographic in the U.S. I wondered, and this was pure speculation, given the links between Pierre Omidyar and elements of CIA and the election of the Hindutva fascist government of Narendra Modi and his BJP and RSS, and also the sympathy that Steve Bannon and Donald Trump had for Narendra Modi, Bannon in particular, and the fact that some of Trump's business partners in India are members of the BJP. I wondered if perhaps Hindutva fascists may have had, in the U.S., had something to do with the ascension of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Well, I don't know about Hindutva fascists. Sekhat Chakrabarty is an interesting fellow. He is from Fort Worth, Texas, became a multimillionaire in Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and then in 2016, rather, suddenly became transfixed by Bernie Sanders, underwent an apparent Damascus Road conversion, and suddenly decided it was time to pump new blood into the Democratic Party. In a recent Instagram post that came out of the AOC camp, Sekhat Chakrabarty is wearing a Subhas Chandra Bose T-shirt. Subhas Chandra Bose was an Indian national leader who, like many nationalists, quite a few nationalists during the 1930s and 1940s, turned to the Axis and their powerful armies as vehicles for freeing themselves from European colonial domination. Subhas Chandra Bose, allied with both Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan, his Free Indian Legion was incorporated into the Waffen-SS. He networked directly with Heinrich Himmler, Reichsführer-SS, and he met with and was lauded in a speech by none other than Adolf Hitler. To make a very long story very short, Americans know nothing about Subhas Chandra Bose. Indians know a great deal about him. It is inconceivable to me that if Sekhat Chakrabarty were what he pretends to be, he would be wearing a Subhas Chandra Bose T-shirt. That just does not compute. That dog won't hunt. The so-called progressive sector and the mainstream media have been effectively silent about that. However, the alt-right slash fascist blogosphere has been making a lot of that, and Fox News has touched on the subject as well, correctly identifying Mr. Chakrabarty's T-shirt as having the face of an Axis collaborator. One of the things that is so important about the Jim DiGiamio interviews, I said that many times, in that was the synthesis of the intelligence community, members of the media, and also the justice system, both Clayshaw's defense team, the Department of Justice, the Attorney General. I wonder if we are looking at that here. I have got my doubts if people at Fox News knew who Subhas Chandra Bose was. Certainly some of the alt-right slash Nazi people do. He is well known in the esoteric Nazi circles that are extant on the internet, but I've got my doubts that Fox News would have known about them. I note that they were blasting Chakrabarty appropriately in this context for having glorified in effect or touted a Nazi and SS collaborator, but this came at the same time as Botox McConnell, Mitch McConnell of Texas, was attacking the Democrats as anti-Semites because of the comments of Representative Ilhan Omar of Minnesota. Perhaps we'll get to her at some point. I wonder if, in fact, Chakrabarty was deliberately coordinating this Instagram appearance with Subhas Chandra Bose on his T-shirt to help provide fodder for the right-wing slash alt-right slash Nazi blogosphere, for Team Trump, for Fox News, and to be coincident with Botox McConnell and his attacks on the Democrats as anti-Semitic. Again, I've got my doubts that the folks at Fox News, who aren't the most sophisticated people in the world, would know who Subhas Chandra Bose was without being cued to that. Maybe a few of them might have remembered him from their Adolf Hitler coloring books when they were in Nazi preschool. But, you know, all kidding aside, I've got my doubts.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, we're going to talk about Sekhat Chakrabarty and also his co-founder of Brand New Congress, a fellow of Turkish extraction named Cenk, C-E-N-K, Uygur, U-Y-G-U-R. Chakrabarty, we apparently can conclude, is something of a devotee of Subhas Chandra Bose. If he were what he pretends to be, he would have had, Gandhi or somebody like that. He has to have known who Subhas Chandra Bose was and what he did. Cenk Uygur has a history of denying the Armenian genocide, and we're going to talk about that in a minute. What I wonder is if they are really what they pretend to be, or are they really undercover right-wingers, very possibly even spooks, who are using the far left, or what will be represented as the far left, to basically destroy the Democrats in 2020 and to shatter the Democratic Party, divide and conquer. I note very quickly that the German Communist Party in the early 1930s bears a measure of responsibility for the rise of Hitler. In the 1932 German parliamentary elections, they voted for the Nazis because they felt, first of all, that the Nazis would drive the German electorate to the left and that they would benefit from that. Their campaign slogan was, "The Social Democrats are worse than Hitler." That has to be something of a New World's indoor record for famous last words. I wonder if perhaps people within the far right and perhaps CIA are doing something similar. Sekhat Chakrabarty went to Harvard University, made millions of dollars in Silicon Valley and Wall Street, and suddenly in 2016 underwent an apparent Damascus Road to conversion to Bernie Sanders. Cenk Uygur is also of an Ivy League pedigree. He went to the University of Pennsylvania. It is inconceivable to me that if he weren't a fascist of some kind, perhaps a pan-Turkist fascist along the lines of Alparslan Türkeş and the Turkish National Action Party, or perhaps even a Nazi, and there are plenty of those in the GOP, I find it impossible, frankly, to believe that someone as well-educated and obviously intelligent could truly believe that the Armenian genocide was fiction. And these are the driving forces not only behind AOC, but behind the left wing, the quote socialists, unquote, of the Democratic Party. From the blog The Bengal Story by Ananya, A-N-A-N-Y-A, Dasgupta, D-A-S-G-U-P-T-A, of January 18th of 2019, meet Sekhat Chakrabarty, the Bengali-American chief of staff of the feisty New York Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. I noticed something interesting within her Instagram posts. A video of a scruffy-looking young man. I don't think he's scruffy-looking. Actually, I think he's very handsome and intelligent and well-spoken and clear-eyed. Point is, this is no dummy. He's very self-possessed, reflects his background. Again, raised in Fort Worth, Texas, went to Harvard University, made millions in Silicon Valley and Wall Street. He is no dummy. I wouldn't call him scruffy, but that's opinion. a video of a scruffy-looking young man wearing a moss-green T-shirt with Netaji, N-E-T-A-J-I, Subhas Chandra Bose's face embossed on it. In today's world, who finds significance in Bose, let alone find it through a sartorial statement in the U.S.? Meet Sekrat Chakrabarty, the chief of staff of Ocasio-Cortez. Skipping down. Like millions of others, he spent years in Silicon Valley, even co-founding a web design tool named Mockingbird and working on the product team of payment processor Stripe. In between, he walked the corridors of Wall Street for a while. But unlike many, he left all that behind to join the Bernie Sanders campaign. While working on the Sanders campaign, Chakrabarty met Alexandra Rojas and Corbin Trent. Together, they co-founded Justice Democrats, a political action committee whose one-line introduction says, "Our time. It's time to usher in a new generation of diverse working-class leaders into the Democratic Party." Justice Democrats and brand new Congress, a similar committee also co-founded by Chakrabarty, worked together to recruit candidates by engaging with the masses. Out of the thousands of applications they received, Chakrabarty's team supported 12 candidates for the Democratic primaries. The success story of this campaign was the one of Ocasio-Cortez, the only one who was elected to the U.S. Congress. Chakrabarty became her campaign manager and eventually her chief of staff. Now, more from Politico about the Justice Democrats and brand new Congress. Again, both co-founded by Chakrabarty, he of the Subhas Chandra Bose T-shirt, and also Cenk Uygur in the case of brand new Congress. Think divide and conquer here. From Politico by David Friedlander, Friedlander of February 4th of this year to 2019. There is going to be a war within the party, and we are going to lean into it. The Justice Democrats helped get Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez elected. Who are they after next? Although it's Ocasio-Cortez who gets all the headlines, she arguably wouldn't be in Congress in the first place without the group Chakrabarty founded. Justice Democrats, a new central player in the ongoing war for the soul of the Democratic Party. It was Justice Democrats who recruited her in a quixotic campaign early on, providing a neophyte candidate with enough infrastructure to take down a party leader. And it is the Justice Democrats who see Ocasio-Cortez as just the opening act in an astonishingly ambitious plan to do nothing less than reimagine liberal politics in America and do it by whatever means necessary. If that requires knocking out well-known elected officials and replacing them with more radical newcomers, so be it. And if it ends up ripping apart the Democratic Party in the process, well, that might be the idea. There is going to be a war within the party. We are going to lean into it, said Waleed Shaheed, the group's spokesman. The group started meeting up even before the 2016 primary was over, and its members began looking ahead to the 2018 midterms, figuring that any Democratic president would need a very different Congress to get anything done. Along with Cenk Uygur, C-E-N-K-U-Y-G-U-R, the progressive activist and founder of the liberal media company The Young Turks, they started a company called Brand New Congress. More about Cenk Uygur in a second. Subhas Chandra Bose from the International Business Times of March 6th of 2012 by Palash R. Ghosh. Hindu nationalists, historical links to fascism and Nazism. This is about a speech Hitler gave to the officers of Subhas Chandra Bose's Free Indian Legion with Subhas Chandra present. The Führer said of Subhas Chandra Bose, the Netaji, during a speech given to Indian military officers and Indian nationalist Subhas Chandra Bose in Dresden, Germany in 1943, Hitler himself reportedly said, "You are fortunate, having been born in a country of glorious cultural traditions and a colossal manpower. I am impressed with the burning passion with which you and your Nataji Bose seek to liberate your country from foreign domination. Your Nataji's status is even greater than mine. While I am the leader of 80 million Germans, he is the leader of 400 million Indians. In all respects, he is a greater leader and a greater general than myself. I salute him, and Germany salutes him. It is the duty of all Indians to accept him as their Führer and obey him implicitly. I have no doubt that if you do this, his guidance will lead India very soon to freedom. And from Wikipedia about the Indian Legion. The Indian Legion, officially the Free India Legion or Infantry Regiment 950, and later the Indian Volunteer Legion of the Waffen-SS, was a military unit raised during the Second World War in Nazi Germany. Intended to serve as a liberation force for British-ruled India, it was made up of Indian POWs and expatriates in Europe. Because of its origins in the Indian independence movement, it was also known as the Tiger Legion and the Azad Hind Fauj, F-A-U-J. Initially raised as part of the German army, it became part of the Waffen-SS in August of 1944. Indian independence leader Subhas Chandra Bose initiated the Legion's formation. And there are pictures in the written description when it gets published of Subhas Chandra Bose networking with both Hitler and Heinrich Himmler. Subhas Chandra Bose also wrote for the Zeitschrift für Geopolitik, the geopolitical journal of Karl Haushofer, who was a major influence on Hitler and is believed by some to have ghostwritten Mein Kampf, Hitler's autobiography and political manifesto. And again, in the written description for the show, the excerpt from Kevin Coogan's Dreamer of the Day about Subhas Chandra Bose writing for Haushofer's journal.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, Cenk Uygur, the co-founder of Brand New Congress, from the Why Evolution is True blog of April 26th of 2014, after years of denying the Armenian genocide, Cenk Uygur now admits he doesn't know enough about it to say. Skipping down. Curiously, one of the Armenian genocide deniers has been Cenk Uygur. It may be relevant that he was born in Turkey, though his family moved to America when he was young. In 1991, while at the Ivy League University of Pennsylvania, Uygur wrote an article for the Daily Pennsylvanian called Historical Fact or Falsehood, which is straight-out genocide denialism, impugning false claims of genocide to Armenian demands for land and money. He said, quote, "Hence, once you really examine the history of the time, it becomes apparent that the allegations of an Armenian genocide are unfounded." Then skipping down, in a letter to Salon in 1999, "Every non-American scholar in the field believes it is an open question whether this event was a genocide." Now, this again from a progressive leader, Cenk Uygur, the co-founder of Brand New Congress with Sikap Chakraborty. "It is inconceivable to me that someone with the intelligence and education," again, he went to the University of Pennsylvania, "could deny the Armenian genocide." That is very significant. Now he says, well, he just doesn't know. That is a very important form of Holocaust denial. And the history and significance of the Armenian genocide and the obfuscation of same were discussed in a program called Oleaginous Diplomacy. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians, recorded in October of 2007, and we are going to excerpt that right now.
Now, the title of the broadcast again is Oleaginous Diplomacy, and the subtitle, Who Still Talks Nowadays of the Armenians? Oleaginous diplomacy refers to, it's a complicated term launched here by Christopher Simpson in the book The Splendid Blonde Beast, from which we're going to be drawing our material in this broadcast. It refers to petroleum-based diplomacy, basically. Diplomacy that is based on access to or gaining access to oil. That's what oleaginous diplomacy is. And because much of the petroleum in the world was and is in areas that were at the end of World War I part of the now defunct Ottoman Empire, the realpolitik that set in among the victorious countries in World War I with regard to the administration of the breakup of the old Ottoman Empire, which was one of the defeated countries in World War I, was accomplished primarily with an eye to getting their hands on the oil, because they were one of the dominant factors in the post-war administration of international affairs with regard to the Middle East, post-war being post-World War I international affairs, with regard to the Middle East, was what they call in Texas the all business. And because so much of that all business had to do with things that were in the old Ottoman Empire, the issue of punishing and even recognizing the Turkish war crimes against the Armenians became one of the chips, so to speak, that was bargained away in regard for, or in exchange for, access to petroleum, or the diplomatic, political, and legal slash corporate rights to the all business in the old Ottoman Empire. So when one sees the dust-up that's going on, or the flare-up that's going on today, bear in mind that this has to do with the all business, and bear in mind, too, that the issue of what happened, or what happened with regard to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, set a precedent for international law, which was not only well-recognized by Adolf Hitler, but which also basically set a precedent for a similar and more drastic cover-up of genocide and of fascism at the end of World War II, which set the stage for not only the Cold War, but also for the post-Cold War resurgence and, I believe, triumph of international fascism. We're going to take a look at some of the people who were involved and some of the elements involved in covering up Nazi genocide against Jews and others in World War II, and their role in helping to administer the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, and that cover-up took place to get access to petroleum. And it is because of that cover-up that Adolf Hitler was able to say, when he was speaking to his generals, basically, "Who still talks nowadays of the Armenians?" And that basically was the rationale, or one of the things that had affected Hitler's attitude toward what he felt was the necessary extermination of peoples who threatened his and what he felt was the German national agenda. What we're going to do now is to turn to the book that's going to comprise the vast bulk of our program. It's going to comprise all of the rest of the information on the broadcast. This is a book called, we're going to be reading from a book called The Splendid Blonde Beast, subtitled Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century. It's authored by Christopher Simpson, and what it talks about is, again, surprise, surprise, money, law, and genocide in the 20th century. And we're going to take a look, first of all, at how the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians influenced Adolf Hitler's worldview and policies. And we're also going to take a look at how oleaginous diplomacy, the access to oil, or diplomacy based on the access to oil, led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians so that people basically could get access to the petroleum that was available in the now dissolving Ottoman Empire. Now, Christopher Simpson's Splendid Blonde Beast, published in softcover by Common Courage Press, copyrighted by Christopher Simpson, 1995. And we're going to take a look at his account of the influence of the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians on Adolf Hitler's genocidal policies. Hitler was well aware of Turkey's genocide of Armenians and of the failure of the international community to respond adequately to it. As early as June of 1931, Hitler commented in an interview that the extermination of the Armenians had led him to the conclusion that the masses of men are mere biological plasticine over which Aryans would eventually triumph. He returned to this theme in a formal talk to his commanding generals on the eve of their invasion of Poland in 1939. Quote, "Our strength is in our quickness and our brutality," he exclaimed. "Genghis Khan had millions of women and children killed by his own will and with a gay heart. History sees only in him a great state builder. Thus, for the time being, I have sent to the East my death's head units with the order to kill without pity or mercy all men, women, and children of the Polish race or language. Only in such a way will we win the vital space that we need. Who still talks nowadays of the extermination of the Armenians?" On at least three other occasions, Hitler pointed to the brutality of Turkey's regime and its willingness to strike without mercy as a worthy model for his own government. So again, the fact that, again, as Christopher Simpson writes here, Hitler pointed to the brutality of Turkey's regime and its willingness to strike without mercy as a worthy model for his own government is one of the reasons why we're going to be taking a look at what took place with regard to the oleaginous diplomacy that covered up the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. Now, the Ottoman Empire had existed for centuries. It was dissolving in World War I. It was allied with Germany and the Central Powers in World War I. This, by the way, to a certain extent for the benefit of younger listeners. When Turkey basically, what we call Turkey today, and the empire of which it was the hub, when it was defeated in World War I, it was dissolved. Younger listeners might perhaps want to get a hold of the movie Lawrence of Arabia. It talks about a portion of this conflict, and it's more or less historically accurate. After the regime which was in power during the closing phase of the Ottoman Empire, and which basically was the architect of defeat or military defeat, that defeat really was the product of a long process of social and political decay. But the Itihad Party, and I may not be pronouncing that correctly, Ittihad, the Itihad faction, perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians, a largely Christian minority sect within the Ottoman Empire. That genocide killed some 1 million Armenian, or members of the Armenian minority. And when the Itihad were replaced by a guy named Kemal Ataturk, who basically is viewed correctly as the architect or father of modern Turkey, among the things that basically became a political football and a major negotiating point and a point of considerable friction was the treatment of many of the people involved with the genocide against the Armenians. This was true for a couple of reasons, or really for several reasons. From the point of view of the people under Ataturk, the new political masters of Turkey, the fact that many of the people that they needed in the military and political and civic establishment for the furtherance of a relatively new, modern, and reformist Turkey were people who, to one extent or another, were directly or indirectly involved with the genocide against the Armenians. There was also the issue of national pride / public relations. It wasn't exactly the best event to have serve as sort of a cognitive launch of the, quote, new, unquote, Turkey in terms of people's background perceptions. From the side of the victorious powers in World War I, the British, the French, and the Americans, they were taking a look at the old Ottoman Empire, and they were taking a look at all the oil, the vast petroleum prize within various parts of what had been the old Ottoman Empire, including Saudi Arabia and what we now call Iraq and Iran. And basically, they were looking to get their hands on the oil business. So oleaginous diplomacy, diplomacy based on the access to oil, became the dominant consideration. And as Christopher Simpson points out, Kemal Ataturk was very skillful in bargaining the exoneration not only of many of the people that had perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians, but also to an extent the actual formal condemnation of the Turkish nation itself in exchange for access on the part of the victor nations to the oil business. Oleaginous diplomacy was the foundation of the cover-up of the genocide against the Armenians. It's what James Stewart Martin, near the end of his book, All Honorable Men, the book that I used to such an extent in the Uncle Sam and the Swastika archive show, and also in For the Record 511, something of a reprise of that archive show. It's what James Stewart Martin referred to as a matter of business necessity. And it was what was viewed as business necessity that also led to the cover-up of the Nazi genocide against the Jews and others in World War II. And among the people whom we've looked at in the past in connection with that is Alan Dulles. Alan Dulles, a lawyer, along with his brother John Foster Dulles in the powerful Wall Street law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell. Alan Dulles, who along with his brother and fellow Sullivan and Cromwell operative John Foster Dulles, helped to invest the money of, among others, the Bush family in Nazi Germany, in Nazi industry. Alan Dulles was deeply involved in the creation of Saudi Arabia, along with Nazi spy Jack Philby, as well as King Ibn Saud, the founder of, quote, modern, unquote, Saudi Arabia. And Alan Dulles also had much to do with the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. One of the people he worked with very closely was a diplomat who worked in various capacities, a fellow named Bristol, who was openly contemptuous of the Armenians. He hated a great many people, but he felt that it was in the interests of the United States to get their hands on the oil and to keep the Turks strong, and that basically who cared about the Armenians. And Bristol worked very closely with Alan Dulles, the same Alan Dulles who was to work very, very closely with Nazi financial and industrial interests in at the end of World War II. He worked with them long before that, but basically he was able to help to effect a cover-up of the Nazi genocide against the Jews and others, much as he worked to cover up the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, that and as part of the oleaginous diplomacy to gain access to the oil business. Now, we're going to talk about how the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, how the oleaginous diplomacy, how the allocation of early oil rights led to the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians. And one of the lessons that Christopher Simpson draws from this is that basically, ultimately, genocide continues to be performed, and that basically it is overlooked when economic factors are viewed as more important, as they very often are. And that there is, to a certain extent, a precedent that has been set by, among other incidents, the cover-up of the Turkish genocide against the Armenians, that has led to a sort of diplomatic, legal, and international diplomatic and legal inertia that has perpetuated this sort of pro-genocide de facto realpolitik. Now, of the oleaginous diplomacy that led to the cover-up of the extermination or the genocide against the Armenians, Christopher Simpson writes as follows in The Splendid Blonde Beast. Importantly, Britain, France, and the United States were at the time vying with one another to divide up the vast oil and mineral wealth of Turkey's Ottoman Empire. Kemal Ataturk skillfully played the three powers against each other and insisted on amnesty for the Ittihadists who had perpetrated the genocide against the Armenians as part of the price for his support in the division of the defunct empire. Though often overlooked today, the Ottoman holdings were of extraordinary value, perhaps the richest imperial treasure since the European seizure of the New World 4 centuries earlier. The empire had been eroding for decades, but by the time of the Turkish defeat in World War I, it still included most of what is today Turkey, Iraq, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon, Israel, Jordan, and the oil sheikdoms of the Persian Gulf. The European government sensed at the time that the time had come to seize its rich prize and its oil. The British had been the dominant foreign power in the Middle East prior to World War I. Their Anglo-Persian Oil Company, later known as British Petroleum, or BP, and the Turkish Petroleum Company effectively controlled most of the oil reserves in the region. But the French acquired an important mandate in the area during the war, and by 1919 they were seeking substantial concessions from the British. Both countries preferred to keep the U.S.-backed Standard Oil Company of New Jersey, today known as Exxon, out of the area. The U.S. government, meanwhile, opposed many aspects of the European colonial rule in the Middle East, preferring instead what it termed open-door policies, those that facilitated U.S. penetration of new markets and acquisition of new sources of supply. Senior officials of all three Western powers became preoccupied with oil politics in the Middle East. It even led to an awkward new term, oleaginous diplomacy, unquote, that was used for years to refer to government initiatives on behalf of oil companies. Oil, said French Premier Georges Clemenceau, is as necessary as blood, unquote. For a short time after World War I, the three allies pressed the new Turkish government on two fronts. First, they supported tough punishment for Itahadist criminals, payment of damages to Armenians and Greeks for the lives and property lost during the massacres, establishment of an independent Armenian Republic in northeastern Turkey, and transfer to Greece of the port city of Smyrna. Second, they demanded that the Turks surrender all claims to the resources of the former Ottoman territories outside of Turkey proper, particularly the Mosul oil fields in what is today northern Iraq. Although many Turks saw these terms as humiliatingly onerous, the first post-war Turkish government agreed to them in the Treaty of Sèvres, signed in August of 1920. That agreement was hailed at the time as the formal conclusion of World War I. But the Associated Powers could not agree among themselves on the terms of the division of the Mosul oil fields, and new fighting broke out between the Armenian nationalists who sought to establish the republic they believed had been guaranteed at Sèvres, and the Turkish Kemalists, who still regarded Armenia as a part of Turkey. Kemal's embrace of the Itihadists contributed to an escalating cycle of revenge killings and renewed massacres in Turkey. By the end of 1920, the Kemalists were clearly in the ascendance, having established a rival government at Ankara in the center of the country. The increasingly shaky Turkish government at Istanbul, under intense Kemalist pressure to abrogate the Treaty of Sèvres, abruptly shut down the criminal trials of Itihadists. The Western allies then stepped up their jockeying for influence within the Kemalist camp. The U.S. High Commissioner to Turkey was Admiral Mark L. Bristol, a man with a reputation as a bigot and a determined advocate of U.S. alliance with Mustafa Kemal. "The Armenians," Bristol wrote, "are a race like the Jews. They have little or no national spirit and poor moral character," unquote. It was better for the United States, he contended, to jettison support for the Armenian Republic as soon as possible, stabilize U.S. relations with the emerging Turkish government, and to enlist Kemal's support in gaining access to the oil fields of the former Ottoman Empire. Bristol's argument found a receptive audience in the new Harding administration in Washington, whose affinity for oil interests eventually blossomed into the now famous Teapot Dome bribery scandal. As High Commissioner to Turkey, Bristol had considerably more power than might be enjoyed by any conventional ambassador. As the civil war unfolded inside Turkey, Bristol barred newspaper reporters from access to areas where renewed massacres of Armenians were taking place, purportedly to avoid inciting further atrocities against civilians. Now, we've been taking a look at a fellow named Admiral Mark Bristol, who was a bigot, somebody who had no use for the Armenians, he had no use for Jews, but he did feel that it was important for the United States to be on good terms with the modern Turkey of Kemal Atatürk in order to gain access to the petroleum rights that were available within some of the former territories of the Ottoman Empire. And one of the people that he worked with in order to alter policy with regard to investigation and adjudication of the crimes against the Armenians, one of the people that Mr. Bristol worked with was the aforementioned Alan Dulles. It was Alan Dulles, along with his brother and partner in Sullivan and Cromwell, the powerful Wall Street white shoe law firm of Sullivan and Cromwell, who, among other things, not only helped to shape the post-World War I world, but also helped to bring about World War II through helping to advise investments into Nazi Germany, Fascist Italy, and the other powers of World War II. And they then helped to cover up many of the crimes of World War II and helped to set the stage for not only the Cold War, but other events associated with it. And also, one of the things that's interesting about and significant about the Turkish genocide against the Armenians is the way in which it set diplomatic and legal and realpolitik precedents for covering up genocide in the future. Of Bristol's work in helping to cover up the Armenian genocide in order to effect oleaginous diplomacy and the cover-up of the Turkish genocide, and his work with Alan Dulles, we read, turning to, once again, The Splendid Blonde Beast by Christopher Simpson, Money, Law, and Genocide in the 20th Century, published in softcover by Common Courage Press. Simpson writes of Dulles and Bristol. Bristol's correspondent at the State Department in Washington was Alan Dulles. After the Paris conference, Dulles had served briefly as chief of staff to Bristol, then moved on to Washington to become chief of staff of the State Department's Near East desk, just as oleaginous diplomacy, unquote, was reaching its heyday. Dulles supported Bristol's initiatives. Confidentially, the State Department is in a bind. Our task would be simple, he wrote, if the reports of the atrocities could be declared untrue or even exaggerated, but the evidence, alas, is irrefutable, unquote. Dulles wrote in reply to Bristol's request for State Department intervention with U.S. publishers to shift the tone of news reports still dribbling out of Turkey and Armenia. Again, quoting from Dulles's letter, the Secretary of State wants to avoid giving the impression that while the United States is willing to intervene actively to protect its commercial interests, it is not willing to move on behalf of the Christian minorities, unquote. Dulles went on to complain about the agitation in the U.S. on behalf of Armenians, Greeks, and Palestinian Jews. Quote, I've been kept busy trying to ward off congressional resolutions of sympathy for these groups, unquote. The change in the U.S. government's response to the Armenian massacres presents an acute example of the conflicts that often shape U.S. foreign policy. From 1914 to 1919, the U.S. government and public opinion sharply condemned the Turkish massacres. Ambassador Henry Morgenthau repeatedly intervened with the Turkish government to protest the killings, raised funds for refugee relief, and mobilized opposition to the genocide. A close review of the classified State Department archives of the period shows that much of the government's internal reporting on Turkey was strongly sympathetic to the Armenians throughout the war and the first months after the war. The Western press, too, was overwhelmingly favorable to the Armenians and hostile to the Turkish government. One recent study by Marjorie Hospian Dobkin found that between April and December of 1915, the New York Times published more than 100 articles concerning the massacres when the killings were at their height. All of the New York Times coverage was sympathetic to the Armenians, and most of the news stories appeared on the front page or the first three pages of the newspaper. A roughly similar pattern could be found in publications such as the New York Herald Tribune, Boston Herald, and Atlantic Monthly, and in the journals of various Christian missionary societies. The volume of news coverage rose and fell with events over the next 5 years, but on the whole it remains strongly sympathetic to the Armenians. Yet, a remarkable shift in U.S. media content and government behavior took place as the new Harding administration established itself in 1921. Quote, those who underestimate the power of commerce in the history of the Middle East cannot have studied the post-war situation in Turkey between 1918 and 1923, unquote, Dobkin writes, again quoting from Dobkin. There were, of course, other political factors that proved disastrous for the Armenians, but the systematic effort, chiefly by the Harding administration, to turn U.S. public opinion towards Turkey and away from the Armenians was purely and simply motivated by the desire to beat the rival Associated Powers to what were thought of as the vast, untapped resources of that country and chiefly its oil, unquote. I'm still quoting, "It is not possible to bring about the desired change in public opinion without denigrating what the Americans had suffered," unquote. She continues, "Retired U.S. Admiral William Colby Chester joined Admiral Mark Bristol as a leading public spokesman for reconciliation with Turkey. Chester was himself not a disinterested party. The Turkish government had granted him an oil concession in Iraq that was potentially worth hundreds of millions of dollars." Writing in the influential journal Current History, Chester contended that the Armenians had been deported not to deserts, but to, quote, "the most delightful and fertile parts of Syria at great expense of money and effort," unquote, a claim that went well beyond even what the Kemal government was willing to argue itself. Dobkin reports that missionary leaders such as Cleveland Dodge and George Plimpton, who had once been instrumental in documenting the genocide, began to lend their names to publicity, insisting that the reported Turkish excesses had been, quote, "greatly exaggerated," unquote. By mid-1923, the complex and interlocking challenges created by the demands for justice in the wake of the Armenian genocide on the one hand, and the U.S. political and commercial interests in Turkey on the other, had been settled in favor of a de facto U.S. alliance with the new Kemalist government. The day-to-day details of the U.S. diplomatic shift in favor of Kemal were handled by Ambassador Joseph Grew, who will reappear later in this narrative as acting Secretary of State during a pivotal moment in World War II, and the chief of the Near East Desk at State, Alan Dulles. The U.S., which had been the principal international supporter of the nascent Armenian Republic, withdrew its promises of aid and protection. Mustafa Kemal soon succeeded through force of arms in suppressing Armenia and in establishing a new Turkish government at Ankara. In July of 1923, the Turks and the European allies signed a new agreement replacing the aborted Treaty of Sèvres with the Treaty of Lausanne. Western governments agreed to new Turkish borders, officially recognized Kemal's government, abandoned any claim on behalf of an Armenian republic, and specifically agreed to an amnesty for all Ittihadists who had been convicted in the earlier genocide trials. As things turned out, many of the top Ittihadists who had fled Turkey in 1918 were eventually assassinated by Armenian commandos. So again, note a number of things. Note how the scramble for oil rights in the old and now dissolving Ottoman Empire basically led to realpolitik, which in turn covered up the genocide against the Armenians. And note how basically it was a relatively cynical process in which, in order to gain access to the petroleum rights, Kemal insisted on certain things. And note how Alan Dulles and other people who were later involved with covering up genocide after World War II or during World War II, note how they got busy doing this in World War I. And note, in turn, how some of the people involved here were directly involved with things that are very much on the front burner today. People involved with shifting sympathy in the direction of the Turks who owned oil rights in Iraq. So it's a very interesting state of affairs. People like Admiral William Colby Chester, who had an oil concession in Iraq that was worth hundreds of millions of dollars, probably more than that today. And eventually they worked through people like Alan Dulles, through people like Mark Bristol, through people like Joseph Grew, people who also helped to cover up Nazi genocide in World War II. They worked to cover up the Turkish genocide in World War I. And now, basically, the perpetuation of that big lie is something that's very much on the front burner today.
Again, the history of the Armenian genocide and the denial of same, the power brokers like Alan Dulles and forces in the oil industry, front and center in that. And again, Cenk Uygur, educated in the Ivy League University of Pennsylvania, co-founder with Subhas Chandra Bose, exponent Sikat Chakrabarty, co-founder of Brand New Congress, and Chakrabarty, and his organization, Justice Democrats, backers of AOC. More about this in our next program. However, this concludes For the Record program number 1061, Socialists for Trump and Hitler, Part 1, being recorded on March 12th of 2019. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.